and the emphasis that a lot of the predictions were mathematically based or based on the only technology they had at the time, very limited telescopes. And all these guys, the major players plus these guys, have put together a story, right? And this is what their story ends up being. They've discovered what we call the life cycles of stars. Stars follow different paths, all depending upon their mass. And depending on the mass, stars die with different events. All stars can be classified on what we call an HR diagram. Basically, temperature on one scale, brightness on the other scale, and stars spend most of their lives like on this major line here, the main sequence. In fact, our sun itself will spend most of its time where it is right now, sitting right over here in the main sequence. Then once it starts to undergo its death throes, it will start to swell. And it will start shrinking back down again. And then it will kick a different engine to burn, start to swell again. Then will slide over here and end its life as a white dwarf. And this gives you an idea of the sun's age right now is about 4.5 billion. It will spend about 9 billion years here. 1 billion years is a red giant. 100 million is a yellow giant. 10,000 years as a planetary nebula, and will end itself as an object which we call a white dwarf. That would be the path of our sun. So we discovered, first of all, the energy that makes stars typically produce the energy that we see. The most common engine is what we call the proton-proton cycle. And it's a very simple process, but bottom line is every time it does this step, every time it takes hydrogen and produces helium, it kicks out energy. And that's what we get there. If the star was a bit larger, it can undergo an alternative sequence called the carbon, nitrogen, oxygen cycle. Again, the bottom line is, if you kind of see it, it's building its way up the atomic scale, periodic table. It's making its way up there. Does anybody know where it has to stop? Do you have a large enough iron? Why iron?
If it uses iron, it's not gaining energy anymore.
Perfect. Stars are lazy. If you can get something by combining things together,
that's cool. But if you have to do some work and you're going to get less stuff out of it, I know, just like your bedrooms, you know, you have to do work to make it tidy. It's easier to let nature do its natural course. You can just explain that to your parents. It's, you know, it's just thermodynamics, Mom. Just thermodynamics, right? And different processes. And as you said, they end up with iron. So good stuff. All right. So if it ends up with iron, well, the cool stuff is what happens to the stars. Where do they die? So currently, our sun is surviving because it's a perfect what I call nature's biofeedback. The force of gravity is trying to collapse it, but the pressure from the thermonuclear reactions are trying to blow it apart, and they basically equal each other. And the star, like our sun, stays relatively very, very stable. And you notice it will spend most stars spend most of their life in that position. We also know that atoms, and I put both of these things to make everybody happy. Those of you who like this nice little Bohr thing, but those of you who understand what this really says, right? Consists mostly of empty space. Okay. You're happy? Yeah, okay. So mostly of empty space. Okay. Right? So nucleus, electron, And one of them says electron, well, we all know where it is, that probability wave and that whole thing. So because you've got the pressure balanced by the gravity, balanced by the thermal pressure going out, the Pauli exclusion principle, which you may have heard about or may know about in school, basically gives us, if you think about it, it's like spin up, spin down. This is where we have to get. We can only pack 2 electrons in this in the shell location right here. And it prevents, the Pauli exclusion principle basically prevents it from going any further. Okay? In fact, we could actually do some calculations. And I did some numbers very, very quickly, just plugging in the masses into this equation, which is from Chandra. Oh, you can't remember the name? Yeah, that guy? OK. This is what he came out with, right? And it basically says when you plug in all these numbers, you do some fun math, right? You get a size that will give us a size limit and a mass limit that becomes held up by this electron degeneracy pressure. So that's what he came up with this. And this object is what we call a white dwarf. So, and by the way, if you look at that size was about the same size relative to the Earth. So he said the theory says that a star like our sun would burn its fuel, and then it runs out of basically hydrogen, so it goes up the chain as far as it can possibly go until it runs out of fuel. And when it starts to run out of fuel, it will start to collapse, right? So first of all, when it runs out of fuel, like anything else, it burns the fuel from the core, and it keeps burning the fuel on the outside. So that's why it seems to swell first. It's just like I'm out of fuel in the middle, so I'll burn the fuel on the outside. So that's why the outer surface seems to move further and further away. Our sun's outer surface will move to just inside Earth's orbit, give you the size, to give you an idea how big our sun will become. And then when it's run out of fuel there, all that's left is this core, right? This white dwarf core. But if our theory is correct, if Chandra's theory is well, you know the heat analysis, but if his theory is correct, then what's going to happen is we should see evidence of this. We should see evidence of that core, which Eddington had predicted in the telescope that you pick her out. But there should be some residual outside stuff from the leftover expansion of the atmosphere of the sun as it was burning that fuel. Okay? Now, notice that a star, typically a 7 solar mass star, actually all stars that are within this range, are reduced to about 20% of the mass. So a lot of the mass of the star is actually pushed out in the atmosphere and just left floating around in space. But if it's there, if this guy is still producing some heat energy, maybe we'll see some ionization taking place. So if it's true, then we should see visual evidences of stars which are hot in the center, which have wonderful ionized colors on the outside that almost look like it's the outside shell that has been basically blown away. And so our telescopes go and look. Oh, sorry, I got one more. It just summarizes everything. Oh, there's what I was getting. There we go. So if it's right, our images should be able to show this. And if you look right there, there was the core. And on the outside, you can sense the energy of the outer parts of the star as it was undergoing expansion as well as burning. And you can see almost the radiation out from the center. One picture does not give enough evidence. There's another white dwarf. Spirograph nebula. You guys had that when you were young? No? Yeah. Again, notice. Right in the center. Right in the center. Yes?
Why do they all look different?
Because not all stars have the same proportions of matter. See, most stars
are more than the first generation, the second generation old, so they have heavier elements inside there. So depending what elements in the outer levels, when it was undergoing the last parts of its life and burning its way up, we get different chemical elements and therefore different shapes. And if there are different density levels, we may get a non-symmetrical distortion as the star burns fuel in one side faster than the other. Also, the orientation that we are, how we're looking at the shell as well. Sometimes we see the shells bubbling out this way. Sometimes we're looking right through the center, so it looks like a ring, like the Ring Nebula. It's actually a sphere, but we're just looking right through the core. So they'll all have some slight visual differences, but there are quite a few that look very, very identical. And unless you're an astronomer, you'll say, hey, I know that one. I've seen four or five very, very similar pictures. So the next question was, remember Chandra said about 1.4? Next question was, what above 1.4? What happens if we could produce something where the electron degeneracy pressure can no longer hold it? In fact, he said then he applied quantum and relativity, because what's happening becomes relativistic. When this occurs, what happens to the star? So above 1.4. This is what happens. We're zooming into the core to see the process, and if you look very, very carefully, something amazing is going to happen. It can no longer support itself, and it starts to collapse. So it went right through what would normally be the white dwarf stability zone, and would produce itself into this thing called a supernova. Now, something interesting with supernovas, because we have a couple of types of supernova. The first one is type 1A, and this is one where we have a binary system. And so we typically have two stars which are locked in an orbit of each other. One of them typically runs out of fuel first and will undergo its normal processes and becomes a white dwarf. And it spends some stability as a white dwarf and a secondary star. After some time, the secondary star itself will run out of fuel, and it will become a red giant. And a lot of the surface will be gobbled up by the white dwarf. But once the mass of the white dwarf, remember, it can only support itself up to 1.4. Above 1.4, it can no longer support itself. It has to collapse as a supernova. So they're not very good for interesting for black holes, because the event that takes place here destroys the actual star itself. So we really do not get anything left over. It blows itself apart, as well as the poor little companion that was sitting beside it. But we use this because it's what we call a rung of the stepladder for distances for us. Because we know in type 1 supernovas, they all trigger at 1.4 solar masses. And at 1.4 solar masses, when they trigger, they all should have the same brightness, because they all have this, they all trigger at the same point. And if it's dimmer, it must be further away. And so we can use it as a step ladder to basically sit there and say, well, if it's this bright when it's a type 1 supernova, it should be this distance. If it's this bright, a lot dimmer, then it should be that distance. And so we just use the laws of luminosity to help us pinpoint how far things are. So we use these guys as a great place. It's kind of neat, but no use for black hole cosmologists. Okay? These are the ones that we want, type 2s. Okay, so this is a star itself which itself is so massive that it run out of, that the fuel can no longer support itself. And this is one that becomes a neutron star. Now, notice the original star here. We're about 40 solar masses. Remember, we lose a lot of the mass of the stars when it's burning its fuel and blowing it and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Plus, when the actual supernova event takes place, it blows away a lot of the stellar mass. And the remaining core is larger than 1.4, so it itself has to collapse into a core that is basically made out of neutrons. And again, it stopped from collapsing any further due to not electron degeneracy pressure, but neutron degeneracy pressure. So this is some of Zwicky's work. And what does it summarize to? Well, it's basically about three solar masses. The number three really comes from Oppenheimer. Temperature is about 1 million degrees in cooling. A star, let's say up to three solar masses, will have a diameter of 20 kilometers. That's the size of a city. So you can think of a star three times as massive as our sun, the size of a city. Density, well, this number really doesn't mean anything, but if you think about this, that a sugar cube will weigh 400 billion tons. All right? That's pretty intense. Plus, stars have something called angular momentum. And when they've collapsed, that angular momentum must be conserved. So neutron stars most likely will be spinning very, very rapidly. Okay. Now again, it was a theory. Just like the white dwarfs hypothesis was demonstrated through by the use of telescopes and the pictures, and say, there it is. There are actually the objects that our theory said. This was just a theoretical object. How do you look for, number one, how do you even see something the size of a city? Where do you even look?
If it's a neutron star, doesn't that mean it's neutral?
No, magnetic field is different. It's like neutrality doesn't mean that you're not having a magnetic field.
Where is the magnetic field coming from?
They come from the star itself, right? Has it's built into its core magnetic fields, right? Magnetic elements that generate that. So this cannot be lost, it has to be retained. Right? So in fact, it's the distortions about the magnetic fields are very useful for us because we'll use them for detecting that they produce something that we'll see later on. Okay? Yeah. But no, just because it's neutral does not mean it's not going to have a magnetic field. So how do we even look for these things? It's nice in theory to say that this is what should happen. But we've got to look for something. It was 1968. Remember I said it took 1968 before these things were actually verified? And it was verified actually by accident by Bell and Hewish. Like any physicist, he didn't have very much money. And he wanted to basically look at radio waves. So he sat there and said, OK, how do I build a radio telescope with very little budget? Chicken wire. So you get yourself as a researcher, and then you get your PhD student to do all the work for you, right? And he made this whole field. You can see it's actually a field out of wooden things, and it's basically wire hanging out. And he made his assistant, of course, do all the collecting all the data. He came up with the idea. Right, and what will happen is they collect all the idea. He puts his name on the title, of course, and you're a little line at the bottom. So he discovered this object, right, which they call pulsars. They were hearing this tick, 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 tick. Now, first of all, they thought this is the first contact with somebody intelligent, first intelligent life, because no feature in the universe could produce something that's that rhythmic. Only intelligent life form could produce a signal that was so precise. Right? So it was as if ET was phoning home.
but just saying tick, 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 tick. So E.T. had a slight stuttering problem, I guess. The paper was being read, like anything else, and somebody says, you know what? There was a theory about these things called neutron stars, and the theory was that these things were spinning. What would happen, because of the magnetic field, but the magnetic field axis, if the axis was just happened to be spinning this way, and let's say you guys are the chicken wire, and I'm the pulsar, and this is my pole. Oh, here we go. Make sure the lid's on tight. And every time one of the ends hit, you would hear the tick, 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 tick. So what they were hearing was a neutron star spinning this way, such that the beam from the magnetic axis was flashing by Earth. Tick, 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 tick. And it was going so fast, right? Well within the realm of a neutron star, right? Remember I said? Here's our evolution, 1 second, 0.0001 second, depending on the size. So they had actually discovered the process of a neutron star. So they did what every other astronomer did. They said, okay, if this is true, we must have evidence of this. So we find a ticking pulsar, which was called, the Crab Nebula. They went to the archives and said, did anybody actually have a record of a supernova, a big explosion that should be bright enough to see in the archives? And actually China did. So China actually had records of this star that appeared in the daytime. It was so bright, it appeared in the daytime. It lasted for a couple of days. And they said, okay, I'm hearing ticking. There's a record in the Chinese archives that said that there was this bright light that appeared for a couple of days and slowly thinned out. Let's point our telescopes at that and see what we see. So here's a picture from, let's say, the Hubble telescope. I think this is actually from the Hubble. This is a picture of the Crab Nebula. And so we start using our technology. Now, some of this technology we have here is very, very recent. So you're going to see something amazing. So I'm going to go from different images of different telescopes into the area where the ticking took place. Okay? Remember, this neutron star is a hypothetical object. Now we're hearing evidence, and now we're going to see if we see evidence, because we know where to look. So we're going to zoom in. So I'll pause here for a second. Now, you don't want to convince yourself, but there looks like there's rings of waves of something emanating. Now, you don't know if it's true, or you're just convincing yourself it's true. See what I mean? You're looking at that and saying, I think I see something happening inside the dust, leftover dust from the supernova, right? Well, let's go even closer. So, and then as we go any closer, we'll even use different telescopes, different frequencies. All right, so you're sitting there thinking, whoa. Look, it looks like there's something in there. It looks like there's something shooting out one side and the other side. You remember, tick, 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 tick. So here's a snapshot. Technology advances a bit more. We'll use a couple. Well, actually, I'm going to shift to the Chandra telescope as well as the Hubble telescope in a second. Look at that, right? And you think that's cool? We did sequence of photographs. Ladies and gentlemen, neutron star. Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
The very zoomed out picture, what was the size? What are we relatively?
Off the top of my head, don't know the actual size in. Well, we know it took place. We can actually do some calculations to determine that, right? Because it took place about 1,500 years ago. And so we could actually give a theoretical maximum size, because we know no matter can expand faster than the speed of light. So we could actually create a theoretical size. You know, the angular size in a telescope would be just a piece of fuzz. So it'd be about a size of a big star. So if you look at Jupiter,
about that size of Jupiter looking through an eyepiece, right? That, and then you're looking at and seeing what that looks like when we're zooming in, right? But it's, remember, it's always expanding, right? And we're seeing what this thing looked like about 1500 years ago. But you're seeing the first visual evidence of a neutron star. So the theory predicted the strange object should exist. Lo and behold, we're dead. So first of all, our theory said, hey, we should have these things called white dwarfs. And we saw these beautiful planetary nebulas, which match that. Then the theory says, hey, we should have these things called neutron stars. Lo and behold, we have neutron stars. I wonder what's next. So what happens if our mass is above three solar masses? So not only electron degeneracy pressure can't work, but neutron degeneracy pressure can't work. What happens if the mass is so big that the central core is bigger than these values? What happens if gravity is so strong that neutron degeneracy pressure won't work? How dense can something get? How strong can the force of gravity be? What if the escape velocity is faster than the speed of light? You feel the suspense? S black hole.
I think Hunkai does degeneracy pressure.
Remember that equation I showed you? Yeah. So, but remember that book I gave you, I showed you on gravity by Schultz? That is how they do. Remember, it's not just the equation is just one. You have to. It's a bit of quantum mechanics, a bit of relativity, but a bit of basically Newton and the stellar dynamics and combined. So these guys spent years, actually decades, working on this.
So I'm just giving you the end result. Right? You could probably go and spend a whole class, a whole university class, on determining how to calculate some of these values. And even that, there's still, you know, there's so many parameters involved. Yes?
All the reasons why a black hole is formed.
Yeah, because we sat there and said, okay, the most important question is this. A star, when it runs out of fuel, Chandra said it can survive up to 1.4, and then it becomes something called a white dwarf. And these are the properties of white dwarf. So we look for the properties and we actually see them. Then we have Zwicky, who said, okay, up to about 3, we should have these other properties, and it should be a neutron star, and it should look like this, and it should be created under this environment. And so we saw the neutron star. The next question says, well, what happens if it's above 3? That's what Oppenheimer says. What happens if the mass of the star is above 3? So not even neutron degeneracy pressure can hold itself. And Oppenheimer says, then it will collapse itself into a singularity, which we're going to call a black hole, okay? So it's kind of each of these steps, these limits were produced by different theorists. And then so far, 2 out of 3 have been proved. This is the next thing. Oppenheimer says, if we go above 3, then nothing should stop it from collapsing in on itself, okay? And then it should form a black hole. So. Now, I'm showing you a lot of very cool animations. A lot of these animations are based on theory, but every now and then I'll show you one that's really based on the current understanding of mathematics. These are something like these type of things that Steven Spielberg would produce. You can see the process. Starts collapsing. Supernova event will still take place, but it's still collapsing in the core. Camera's going to zoom out a bit. After the supernova, you're going to end up with an object that you can hold in the palm of your hand. Remember what I said about the size of a neutron star is the size of a city? What I'm doing there is holding up this object called a black hole. And it looks pretty white on the outside, doesn't it? That there is the event horizon. Yeah. Well, that's a size of a black hole. If our sun became a black hole, if a planet became a black hole, if it could, remember we had the different sizes?
So the more massive the star, remember the trick was, the limit was 3. So once, if you get higher, as you get bigger and bigger and bigger, you'll get bigger and bigger black holes. But that's a nice size black hole as it is, right? It's above 3 solar. For sure, that one is going to be easily bigger than our sun, right? Okay, so we haven't even defined the parts yet. So now, not only that, you're thinking of it as an object. I'm gonna freak your mind out even some more. Yet, like, you seen that show Mind Freak? Now we're just starting. Okay, we're just starting. All right. Yeah. No questions are stupid.
Into space and like some astronauts, is
there
just floating in space?
Yeah, they do that all the time.
And there's this black hole. Is it possible for the astronauts to get sucked into it?
Oh, okay, I'll answer that question. Well, actually, keep that question in mind because I'm going to answer that as we go around. First of all, we're pretty confident that there are no, we know for sure. Well, let's see, the closest black hole that we know of is 1600 light years away. It's called V4641. All right, V4641. So there you go, 1600 light years away. But I'll explain what will happen if we did have a large enough, fast enough craft, enough time to visit one. All right. Question that people always are going to ask. So those are some cool questions, because you asked one of the cool questions. So first of all, what would it be like to watch a star crash in a black hole? By the way, remember I said our sun cannot become a black hole. Can you give me at least 2 reasons why not? Oh, perfect. 1 solar mass. So when it goes through its process, it also loses 20% or 70% of its material. So there's going to be no way our sun could become a black hole. Also, if our sun did, by Richard's ability to turn our sun into a black hole just by snapping his fingers, there it is, done. What's going to happen right now? Why not?
Because the gravity acting from the sun's mass would be the same. Because
exactly. So how long would we have to wait before we knew something happened?
Years.
And then what would happen?
Why
would we know that? The Earth will still stay in orbit.
We'll orbit around
an object that has the same mass that doesn't generate any light or heat. So all will happen to us is it will start getting cold, dark right away. It'll start getting cold, but we will still stay in orbit, shivering. Nothing else is going to happen. After a while, we'll all go underground and build bonfires and take our Duracell flashlights. We'll live happily ever after. But the Earth will go on its orbit. The cool stuff only happens around the event horizon. Okay. So if we watch a star collapse, first of all, it's not going to be exciting. We'd actually watch the star seeming to collapse inside, so assume we have our nice thermal energy, because remember, it undergoes this thing from a supernova explosion, but we would actually see the star's outer atmosphere, outer zone, seem to go and shrink, but then seem to slow down, but at the same time, we'd actually see it fade to black, just like in a movie script. So you'll actually almost seem to see the surface of the star tend to be, the term is frozen, and the Soviet Union actually used that term for black hole. They called it a frozen star because the surface would seem to stop. Now remember, it doesn't stop, it's just from our perspective out there, but the surface seems to stop. Okay. Got some equations, but I got them all explained in here so you can plug in numbers, but you can actually determine how bright it's going to be and how long it takes for a black hole to collapse. You can plug some numbers into your calculator and have fun with your friends and your neighbors. All right, this is the one thing people find. How about traveling into a black hole? So first of all, I took a Borg cube ship. All right, so what would happen? Well, first of all,
from outside, we would see the ship seem to be stretched. We'd also see the color shifting, because the light waves from the surface of the Borg ship were also being stretched. They're trying to get away as well. And they would seem to stretch, and it would come to a certain zone, which we call that event horizon again, and it would seem to freeze and hover there. The dudes inside the Borg ship, assuming it's a big enough black hole, would just have a fun time. They're just going in. If it's a really big black hole, they're just going in. Nothing is strange for them. They're enjoying the ride. Except the communications outside. Once they pass the event horizon, something weird would happen. They would lose contact, or we would lose contact from them. Let's watch a clock fall into a black hole. Let's see if I can. I'll just turn up the sound on this one. Let's see. Let's begin our experiment. Stop the clock.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15.
Right? Yeah. Right. So you see, it seemed to right and fall in, but this time dilation was being pronounced. Now this is cool, because with this. With this time dilation, I got a business proposition for you. You know what? I come up with these ideas, and I let you build. I get 10% though. So here's a business offer. How to build a time machine. This is, yeah. First of all, get yourself a space station. No problem. It's a little step. Then get yourself a rocket. Get yourself a volunteer. Okay, insert volunteer inside rocket. Have volunteer and rocket go to our nearest black hole. Have rocket and volunteer get very close to the outside of the event horizon. Note, if rocket and volunteer cross the event horizon, get a new rocket, new volunteer. Try again. So have them go to the event horizon. Now, a volunteer may spend maybe one day of their life just enjoying the neighborhood of the event horizon. Okay? But we know from outside in the space station, his time would be ticking very slowly. So for him, he would spend one nice day eating some nice bistro food, right? Going to the washroom, right? Listening, rereading, and doing some special relativity problems, right? Then he would kick in the afterburners and come back to the space station. And if he arrived at the space station, depending on how close he got to the event horizon, maybe 4 years had passed. So if you, for example, you could set up a business. If you don't like the government that's in looking after your country, go away for a day, come back in a brand new government, right? If you want to go away for 10 years, get a bit closer, come back. 20 years, get even a bit closer, come back. Easy, 10%. Okay, I'll leave my webpage, you can give me a call. So let's have a look at the anatomy of a black hole, because it's got some strange parts. Remember, keep in mind that Schwarzschild solution, the equation, remember we had the two locations where something weird happened? One of them where something big time weird happened, where you divided by zero all over the place. But one of them where the other place where time kind of went to zero when that divide. So this is the first location. This is called the Schwarzschild radius. This is the event horizon. This is where you get closer and closer to it. The time got bigger and bigger and bigger. Once you cross that, you have it's called a singularity. I'll try to define for you what a singularity, but I got a nice little phrase for you later on. you have this thing called a singularity. And then at about 1.5 Schwarzschild radiuses, you have something called a photon sphere. This is like the, if light, because light has a fixed speed, this is where light would come in and stay in a perfect orbit around a black hole. Right? It's at the right speed to stay in perfect orbit. So that's called a photon sphere. So we had the photon sphere and locate. Now these are all mathematical locations, mathematically thin locations, precise locations. An horizon and something called a singularity. These two guys, horizon and singularity, is where we divided by zero. One weenie divide by zero, the other one big macho divide by zero. Right? Now again, I've got more information on that in slides. So this is what a thing, and I love this phrase, a singularity. I got to read this thing. This is cool. I've emphasized a certain word. Within the singularity, matter is infinitely compressed into a region of infinite density. At the singularity, gravity is infinite. Space-time has become infinitely curved. At the present time, science has no tools to describe conditions within a singularity. All laws of physics lose meaning. At a singularity, space and time cease to exist as we know them. The laws of physics as we know them break down at a singularity, so it's not really possible to envision something with infinite density and zero volume. So that's what the mathematics says. The curvature is so intense that there is no mass. The mass itself, the energy of the mass, is bending space-time. And that's the visualization of the embedding diagram. That's the only thing you can visually realize, but it's bending in all directions. So if you think of this funnel, that you visualize as a gravitational well, but it's going in, if the object was there, it's going in every single direction bending into another direction that you can't visually see because it's in a different dimension that we can't even figure. We need four dimensional axes to figure this thing out. That is what a singularity is. It's not a point. It's all the energy is used into bending space-time. So you gotta if you think about it, you got a thing called an event horizon, which is just a location, and you got this thing called a bending, which is just a location, but there is no rock piece that you're sitting there and say, oh, there's a black hole, there's a little piece right there. Right? Infinite density, zero volume. A mathematical point. Okay. So this would be like so we take our embedding diagram. This would be like our horizon. Remember, here's the difference. This is the old radius method that we were so used to on a blackboard. This is the radius. But remember, in a singularity, it doesn't stop. It keeps going. That's why you get an infinite radius. Right? It never stops. What about the photon sphere? Remember I said there was that photon sphere? This is where photons can perfectly orbit. They're going right at the right velocity, just like you need a certain velocity for a satellite to stay in orbit. If they go too slow, they come in. They go too fast, they leave. Well, this is the photon sphere is exactly where the speed of light locks it into a stable orbit. Theoretically, you could imagine yourself sticking yourself into the photon sphere, and the light from the back of your head, which would go in a straight line, would come back and hit your eye. So you can look at the back of your head and check for, am I getting bald back there? I'm not sure. You touch that up, right? Some cool stuff with the photon sphere. Oh, yeah, it's going to the speed of light, so.
Well, like anything else, I think let's assume you're right. So if I got a black hole that is like millions and millions of millions of kilometers, it would take a while. But you know what? I'm in a reasonable size black hole, so that the travel time for light is almost within nanoseconds, so that I can sit there and check things out, right? Right.
You wouldn't see the future, you would just see the
top. Oh, no, you would just see the back of your head, right? You wouldn't see the future. It would act like a mirror, right? 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 But you're right, looking in the past, you just see, because it took a time for the light to come back and hit yourself. But like I said, I'm choosing a nice size one so that, that it's relatively good enough so that I can touch my hair. Oh yeah, for sure, for sure. Now, interesting stuff about this is, remember, this is all mathematically. This would assume, of course, that the light photon had a precise size. We know it doesn't, and therefore, in reality, the light would it's almost like a wave form. Remember that wave duality problem? It would kick itself out or in, one or the other. So it wouldn't be a stable location. What matter? All the matter is being collapsed itself into. It's all been gone into of bending space-time. Yep, it's all gone. It's all the matter itself has collapsed on itself, and it's all being used to bend space-time. I told you this is weird. Now, some other effects, because I've got about half an hour to try to get through to some good stuff. Time dilation. There's the equation. And again, they're on the sheet, so you get to play with them. And there's also one for blue shifts, so you can, again, play with them. I'm not going to spend any time going, but there are nice little equations that you can actually figure out how close you have to be to determine how long time would be dilated or wavelength would be affected, right? The effects. If you're ever falling in, it's best, it's like riding a paddle boat. This is the best. At a certain point, you're trying to get out of a waterfall, and you're going to realize it's fruitless. So turn around and enjoy the ride. So once you're coming inside the event horizon, it twists and it forces time to basically go into the singularity, and you're just following time because time goes forward. So you're just enjoying the ride all the way down. No? Well, does it end? Well, you'll be long gone before you could even attempt to answer that question, because this is what it's going to be like visiting a black hole. So let's see what happens if you can visit a black hole. Well, I'll try to get the question to the end so out so that we can get through this stuff. Okay. So, first of all, you'll see from the outside, we'll see our buddy seem to fade to black. But there's a very precise mathematical term that's going to describe what happens to you if you happen to be the person on the way inside a black hole. The term is spaghettification. It certainly is a word. Google it. If it's on Google, it must be real. Or it's on, what's it, Wikipedia? It must be real, right? Right? So remember we talked about tidal forces? When I drop the two balls and they all go toward the center, there's this process where it's going to stretch me this way as well as compress me this way as well. What's going to happen to you as you enjoy your way inside toward the event horizon is you will be spaghettified. Okay? Now, you will be stretched from head to foot and from every other direction squashed inward, and it's probably not a pleasant experience. But there's some cool stuff. So if you're going to go and visit a black hole, because you know what? Every time you ask people who would want to go and visit a black hole, you will always get volunteers. So if you want to visit a black hole, make sure you visit a large black hole, because the acceleration, the difference between the acceleration on your head and foot is proportional to 1/2 of the mass of the black hole. So the bigger the black hole, the less difference between acceleration. So you can actually enjoy your way inside. So you could actually pass through that guy in the spaceship outside the event horizon. You can wave, right? You'd go right inside and you would feel nothing, right? Until you get closer and closer and closer and closer to the bottom of the well, then you start feeling the spaghettification effects taking over. But
you couldn't let anybody else know about it anyway. So at least you enjoy the ride. You could probably write the ultimate paper, solve all the theories of the universe, tie in and put together quantum loop gravity and string theory, figure it all out, and not be able to tell anybody. That's the way life goes. So I got some fast little animations of what it looks like approaching. So if you actually were approaching a black hole, if you kind of see, there's a little, do you see these three stars over here? There's actually, that's a constellation Orion. But as you're approaching, you see the three stars actually appear over here. So you'll start to see light come this way, but the light that was going behind whips around and comes back as well. So you start to see these unusual distortions. So that's approaching black hole. You're now orbiting a black hole looking down, and you'll see things that are really neat. Rotation seems to be clockwise and counterclockwise. But you know, your feet are moving as well. It's moving at the same. Yeah. Well, no, because that's from perspective. You yourself would probably notice. You may notice a bit of distortion, but you'd basically stay the same. You'd sit there and say, "Hey, this is cool." It's the effects from people on the outside that see that freezing zone. Okay. Looking horizontal, yes.
There's tidal forces because my bones are stretched to the head as well, like my nerves too. So how do you
know? It's like this. Richard grabbed you by the head, I grabbed you by the feet, and we started trying to pull. Even though you got bones and neurons and stuff like that would be stretched, they would stretch to a certain limit before your joints came out of the sockets and you would yell. Yeah. So what's going to happen is the difference in acceleration is going to be stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. So it's almost like experiencing 9 G's on the feet but 0 G's on the head, right? The difference. So you start feeling this thing. So and the smaller the black hole, the stronger that separation of difference of accelerations would be. So your feet would be starting to be pulled apart. Your head would be accelerating, but not as fast as your feet. But then the tidal force would be pushing this way at the same time, and it would be like you turning into a Mr. Noodle or Mrs. Noodle.
Why it's not as comfortable as accelerating fast and experiment with nice contraction. But there, I don't feel anything because everything is contracted.
No, it's not by the same amount. The acceleration is so that it's like, let me reverse this. If I jump up a building, right, my feet and my head will feel the difference in acceleration at different times. So if I jump up a 10-story building, my feet will stop, but my head won't. And you'll be the reverse of a piece of spaghetti. You'll be a pancake. Okay, it's just a reverse that. So if you're at the photon sphere orbiting, what we'll see is kind of neat, right? Kind of dark below, right? But you'll see stars that seem to come towards you and then automatically seem to go away from you. So you'll see something coming, here it comes, here, there it goes, right? Now, if you're falling in and you're looking up, a very similar effect what Richard was talking to you before, a lot of the stars behind you will start to seem to collapse forward. So just like this tunneling effect will take place. So you'll start to see the sky above you start to become more and more focused and more and more brighter. And so it will start looking like that. Now I have an interesting set of views here. I've got a spaceship where you have a forward viewing point, a sideways viewing point, and a backwards viewing point. So you're on a cruise ship visiting a black hole. So at about 100 Schwarzschild radiuses away, the guy in the front sees some sort of distortion. Right? They're seeing distortions around the object. The sideways views, it's kind of nice to see a nice little galaxy. And the guys at the back are seeing
a nice little view of their bound galaxy. But the front guys are murmuring mosquitoes, which is pretty cool. We get closer. We get closer. The guys at the front are saying, wow, look at that. Kind of looks like a black hole. The guys on the side are sitting there saying, hey, this kind of looks kind of like bending over here. And the guys in the back are going, okay, it's kind of the same view I had before. Okay. Forward, there's a lot of woos and ahs taking place. The guys on the side are sitting there going, look at this. It's really distortion, and the guys at the back are asleep. The guys at the front are saying, uh-oh. Guys at the side are sitting there saying, is something happening? And the guys at the back are still asleep. We're right at the photon sphere. The guys at the front have already moved to the guys at the back. The sideway view guys are sitting there saying, now that is weird. And the guys at the back are still saying, okay, I'm still, might as well get another, hit that snooze button. Just like somebody we know here. Guys at the front, guys at the side, maybe I see a bit of distortion happening. The guys at the back are finally getting the money's worth, right? At 1.2, right? Then the guys at the back were starting to see that tunneling effect take place at the beginning. So we get further and further in. Finally, they see something that is kind of exciting. Okay? Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. All right. Fast anatomy stuff. So again, we talked about this. We have a singularity, an horizon, and a Schwarzschild radius. Okay? Just to emphasize, it's not a vacuum cleaner. Right? Only the strange effects happen around the event horizon. Okay? If you get further enough away, the bending is so little, it's the same sort of laws that govern Newton geometry will work. That's why if our sun turned into a black hole, we would still stay in orbit. That's, if a black hole came into our solar system, we would kind of know it, even though it didn't have to come anywhere near us, it would still have the effect. So if there's a three solar mass black hole, we would know that planets were disturbed just as if there was another star in the solar system that had the mass of three times the mass of our sun. But nothing's going to go, all of a sudden those stars are going to just change their orbits and go flying into us. Not like a giant vacuum cleaner. The cool stuff only happens, as you can tell, when we get closer to the event horizon. We have more than one type of black hole because the solutions I've been talking to you have just been the Schwarzschild solutions. But that assumes that the black hole doesn't rotate, has uniform density. Remember I said it was the billiard ball version? People needed some time to figure out, well, stars do rotate. And it takes a while for us to figure out the different types of solutions to the field equations. So, Risen Lodestone solution is a black hole that has electric charge. They said, what happens if it starts gobbling up electrons? So you have a disbalance of charge, so it becomes charged one way or the other. Their solutions say, if this occurs, you'll end up with two horizons, an inner horizon as well as an outer horizon. And the more the charge, the closer these guys get together. So we figured that's not going to be, we don't normally find planets which are positive charge and negative charge. So it was just a nice little solution. A more accurate one is a rotating black hole. All right. This is a Kerr solution. Yep. One's back. Oh, yeah. I've got something in here. I could spend about an hour trying to explain these type of diagrams, right? They're kind of nice. You can play. It allows you to use the singularities to visit different universes. But it's a totally different. Okay, we'll talk. They're inside there, but it's fun with mathematics. That's all it is. Fun with mathematics. There we go. Okay. Yeah. So. What happens if it rotates? So first of all, we get two event horizons, an innie and an outie, just like belly buttons.
right? You get a zone, right, called an ergosphere, where you space itself cannot stay still. You cannot stand still, no matter what, how good you are. If you're Captain Kirk or a Borg commander or Luke Skywalker or even Darth Vader himself, you're moving, no matter how good your engines are, right? We also get two photon spheres. You get two photon spheres, one rotating, one counter-rotating, two horizons, and then you get a singularity, which is toroidal in shape, a donut. So the singularity is a donut. Okay. Kip Thorne likes these ones because you talked about time travel and the fun of these things. Yeah, do some reading on that. These are the beasts that will allow Star Trek and the wormholes to appear and all that fun stuff. But the most important thing for us, it predicts frame dragging. So we now have rotations. We have another physical effect that we can actually look for if general relativity is in fact correct. And we actually have craft right now in orbit around Earth checking for frame dragging around Earth. It's this process where space-time itself is being rotated, so it's dragging itself around. You can't stand still with it. Now in the Earth we can, but within the solution of the Kerr solutions, not enough energy would allow you to stop from moving because the frame itself is moving. So Kerr solution, again, we have this process of having a donut as a singularity. Now the Penrose, again, remember I was talking about Penrose, who used topology to try to explain all these things, right? His theories actually say that eventually, now eventually is a nice word because eventually can mean any amount of time, and it means a large amount of time. But it's possible that eventually a black hole will stop rotating. All right. So some cool stuff, but I want to make sure I get done before you guys get to eat. So we'll move on to there. What about this no hair stuff? Basically, it says whatever goes in to create a black hole, right, loses whatever made it unique, and it becomes part of the mathematical singularity. So, right, it all comes in. The only thing that seems to be retained is mass, charge, and angular momentum. So that's what it basically means. Okay? Mass, angular momentum, everything else, right? If you went in there with a banana split, the banana split and you become part of the singularity. Inside the singularity, there is no banana split, there is no you, right? I know. All stars, different shapes and sizes, right? Whatever they are, they'll all look the same when they become collapsed into a black hole. Okay, that's all it says, right? So I just want to give you fast, just give you an idea. I know I've got some questions, but I got to move on. We'll try and take these things. So, Schwarzschild, only mass was part of the parameter. Okay, Reisner's, we have mass and charge. Kerr, we have mass, angular momentum, and Kerr Newman, he tossed in all three. And look at how long it took between this one and this one. We're talking close to 50 years before somebody was able to go beyond just mass to add some spin to it. And we're still working with spin right now, trying to figure this thing out. This is the latest, one of the latest, actually, it was last year's image of that was done of what they believed it would be like falling into a black hole. You'll notice, though, that it doesn't look black. Okay, there's a lot of energy being radiated from outside the event horizon, right? And don't forget, there is stuff falling in beside you. This would probably be, let's assume it's rotating. I'm not 100% sure, but it looks like it's got some sort of angular momentum, right? But as you're falling in, you'll notice inside, it doesn't quite seem as black as you would think. Everything's coming in. You got it. So you've been looking around. It's all coming in. All this energy is coming in. Entropy. All right. Stephen Hawking basically says that if a black hole has to have entropy, we have this problem about losing information, violation of quantum mechanics. You can't lose this information. So he wanted to conserve this. So classical black hole theorists have no problem with this, but people who like these things like conservation of information seem to have a problem with this object that can gobble up everything and not leave any evidence. So they needed a way. He needed a way to explain what happens to information, and he related it to entropy. And if it has entropy, it must have a temperature. If it has a temperature, then it means it must radiate. Can you see the logic inside it? If it has entropy, it must have a temperature. If it has temperature, it must radiate. But then I said, how can it radiate? Because it gobbles up everything. So we had to figure out a way to explain that. So this is Stephen Hawking's method. And there's quite a few great competing models for this. But I think this is the coolest. So basically, it says, according to quantum mechanics, I have a time frame within this Planck's time frame where particles are created and annihilated, and there's no violation. As long as I do it within a certain amount of time, I can borrow energy, create these two particles, let's say a positron and an electron, and as long as they come back together within that time, everybody's happy. Nobody cares. Nobody's really looking, right? So outside a black hole, you have these virtual pairs, because it's happening all over the place, right in front of you. You see one right there just happened? Right? You'll be very quick. Outside the event horizon, you have these virtual pairs being created and annihilated. And so his reasoning was this. What happens if one pair was created and one of the pieces fell inside the black hole, inside the event horizon? It ain't coming out. So the other dude is escaping. And so from our perspective, from the outside, it would look like, hey, there's this radiation coming from this event horizon. If you could have another scenario, but they both are created and rejoin, we wouldn't notice it. But as one piece goes in, one piece goes out, we would have this piece of particle being radiated. It had to borrow energy to do this, and so it think of it this way: it borrows more energy than it can give back. So it borrowed energy to separate, but it had to give back that energy. But it didn't give it couldn't give it back. So the energy it borrowed from was from outside the event horizon, which then takes the energy away from the black hole, makes the black hole shrink a bit. So this is the term that black holes kind of evaporate. You know, I see where you go. There's a lot more detail inside there to explain. Inside, we certainly do not have the time. So,
I have let's say I have two pairs of this virtual particle.
Okay, so they're think of photonic in nature, right?
And of each of these pairs, one falls inside the black hole, and these two other are exactly that so charged that they can annihilate. So I think I have. So there won't be any energy leaving the platform.
Yeah, because it had to borrow. It borrows energy to break apart, but it couldn't give the energy back to recombine.
Let's say we have black particles and white particles, and there's equal probability that as well that white particles and black particles.
You're thinking of positive and negative energy. Think of it in photonic in nature. So we'll take this one after. Yeah, it's a lot more complicated than most people think of these things as terms of. And I guess it's part of it. We always use positron and electron to, because most people understand that, but it's really photonic in nature rather than.
The radiation has a temperature, and you could actually determine the temperature of the black hole, and then you could actually determine how long it takes the black hole to collapse, or to evaporate after collapse.
Does it heat up or does it get
warm? Well, you look at the temperature, right? You can sit there and say, this is pretty big. This is not a large temperature, right? But I think the most interesting part is the time.
Yeah.
Because is this factor times the mass cubed? Right? And remember, the age of the universe is just this. So it's going to take a long, long time for black holes to even do that. But if that, this was his solution, and there are other competing models, right? There was a superstring version. Yeah, this is a superstring. You got a brain, you got two colliding strings, just like water coming together, create a bubble, pops up. So they're trying to explain reasoning how, and again, these are all theories. We're not even sure that these things exist yet. And I think Richard was hinting at a new radiation before, right? There's a lot of interesting theories that go along with this, that you'd see these things kicked out. So, question of black holes real. I want to try to get through this because we lost about an hour. Right? So, these are just theories, right? How do we know these things? We have to, just like we look for and saw white dwarfs that are looked for and find and saw neutron stars, how do we look for black holes?
Well, one of the predictions were that if you were matter orbiting a black hole, falling into the event horizon, you would bounce off, the particles would bounce off each other, kick out a lot of energy, a lot of friction, produce a lot of radiation, usually in the ultraviolet X-rays. So we said, I got an idea. If we look, we can look for X-rays. Now, it took a while because X-rays do not penetrate Earth's atmosphere. So it took a while before we actually have X-ray satellites start looking for this. I'll get the questions at the end. Otherwise, we'll never get done. Okay, so that was one of the things. The other thing is that if we look for X-rays, there should be a pattern of energy coming towards, going towards. There must be some sort of an effect that maybe we can see. It was resolved. It was actually resolved when I was about 19, 18 years old, right here, at a place in Toronto, at an observatory that you'll see, where it was discovered by a guy by the name of Tom Bolton that we had an X-ray source that said that I have a huge X-ray source, but when I went to the visible telescope, there was a bright star, but it wasn't exactly where the X-ray source was. And in fact, this bright star was orbiting, and you can see the actual signal right here, every 5.6 days. So it was a 30-mass star orbiting an X-ray source. And when we plug in the numbers, the mass of this X-ray source was above 3 solar masses. So we had an object that we could not see visibly, kicking out X-rays, at a 30-mass star orbiting it. This is the first verified black hole called Cygnus X1. I'm trying to think of the year. It would probably be in the 70s for sure. Even more stars are now being looked, because we look for binary systems. So these are some of the more famous ones, orbital periods. So that's the first evidence. More evidence. When they did the modeling, we find that there should be other physical processes that have to be conserved when a star collapses into a black hole. You can kind of see the emphasis right there. There we go. Let's kick over. gravitational lensing. And what else should we look for? Oh, sorry, jets. Yeah, so modeling says that we should see these along these magnetic field lines, these radiated pieces. So we know what to look for. So we turned on our telescopes again. All right. Turned on our telescopes. And we start looking for stellar objects. That have jet-like extensions. Some of them coming from the cores of galaxies. They're trapped in the magnetic field lines of a collapsing star. So all stars have magnetic field lines, so they're actually trapped on the poles. And because the star is spinning, so you can imagine they're like funnels and they're just kicking stuff out. Very, very, very fast. Very, very energetic. They're the black holes, like active galactic nuclei. There's a lot of very interesting models of what is being bombarded, what could be bombarded by these jets. In fact, they flash across Earth. They could do a lot of damage. So, according to galaxy, it was discovered that galaxies are having jets, and if they have jets. Maybe have black holes. If other galaxies have black holes, what about our galaxy? So we started to survey our own galactic core. Again, we needed other telescopes to look inside. We needed ways to peek through the dust. So our technology had to advance. And when our telescopes advanced, we were able to see part of a jet, but even more important, a blur. Something, there we go. Something happened, kicking out the information. But I've got let me get this thing done. There we go. This is what we started seeing. There we go. Right? Stars around the core where jets were being produced. And so they start tracking these guys. Now look at the size of this object that they're tracking. 3,700,000 times massive than our sun. So we're going to track that. And these are stars moving, by the way. This is the date. So I'm going to zoom in. This one zooms in over there, right? This is where they've been tracking these stars, the motions, trying to determine what's happening. And as they trace around these objects, they're orbiting this object here. And this is within our own core. Okay? Yeah, oh, no. Okay. Right? I'm just going to kick on. No, we've got about 5 minutes. So I want to show you something. There we go. I know that you like to see pretty. This one here is, like, we've been trying to figure out the mathematics how to do this. In 2005, that's not too long ago. It was the first time we were actually able to mathematically simulate black holes orbiting and collapsing each other. This is how recent we are. And even to do this, Franz was able to do this. He only had 5 orbits. So this is the actual, he sent me this, I got this last night from him. So this came through. Time, these, right? This is color. So it's funny, this is, the redder they are, the longer, the more time is stretched as referred to somebody looking from the outside, right? So it's an unusual type of diagram. Right? It actually before we had to use different techniques. We used excising techniques, different mathematical tools to try to figure this thing out. This was the first time somebody actually produced a real mathematical simulation of rotating and collapsing black holes. And he did it using wave techniques and using a lot of ingenuity. 2006, we had two other solutions. And in a second, I'm going to show you the one that came out last year. Right? There. This came out last year. Last year, we were the first people to actually display this. This is the largest calculation ever done on NASA's supercomputer system. It's called the Columbia system. This is what happens when black holes orbit around each other, and they generate these objects called gravitational waves. Now, these gravitational waves are going to be the only evidence that we can actually check to verify that these objects really do exist with the strangeness that I've talked about, all these different strange time dilation effects. It's so important that we have a series of detectors around the world looking for these gravitational waves, like LIGO, Virgo, GEO 600, Tama, Auriga. And in fact, right, this guy right here, which is Kip Thorne's baby, Kip Thorne, the same guy that people have been mentioned before, is on the team that's going to be sending up the LISA system, the Laser Interferometry Space Antenna, which will be launched probably, I think the time frame was in about 4 or 5 years. Maybe four or five years. 2015. Its only job is to look for gravitational waves. This is how important this is. You realize how little money NASA has for doing things like this. That to launch one satellite or something, you can launch three of them to look for gravitational waves. Because if it can determine that gravitational waves do exist, it means that all the other properties that were predicted from black holes do exist. And therefore, it really is that we've seen visual images of it, right? We've seen distortions, we've seen gravitational lensing, we've seen X-rays, we've seen strange stuff happen. But is the geometry bending like the way we have it? This is the only piece of evidence that we'll be able to get. And hopefully in 2015, give 5 years, we'll be able to produce that. Now, I know you guys have to go to eat, right? You can eat. Here's a sound of what we should be expecting to hear in black holes when they do collapse. Bend in two different directions. So see me afterwards, and I could spend an hour on every one of these little guys, right? Get forward. There we go. Strange predictions, because I know we're going. Prediction number one: gamma ray bursts. Okay. By the way, these are actually images, right? This year, 2008, the largest gamma ray burst was detected. Right, and you can actually see it flare up right there. Right, and there's the actual signal strength that came across. Wormholes, another prediction. This is what everybody seems to like for some reason. There we go. Allows you to travel from one end of the universe to the other without passing go. Okay. Wormholes are an unusual solution the field equations. It's a solution that requires the borrowing of energy from the stress energy tensor. so that we don't have, we have an, the average null density has to be modified in such a way that we can actually create a throat. And then if you carry something called, I guess, exotic matter, that's the best term from it, you can actually widen up the throat. So if you, again, you were Captain Kirk, you have a ship full of exotic matter, you could create a throat wide enough, and you should be able to pass across from one end of the universe to the other if you're a science fiction writer. Naked singularities. What would happen if you have a black hole without an event horizon? Well, then all the laws of physics that we know and love are out, so we have pure chaos. Yeah. Time travel is another aspect. There's my singularity. Right, modern art, yeah. Traveling through the singularity. We can even, there's a patent for extracting energy from a black hole, because remember the ergosphere, nothing can stand still. So you, in fact, could put a part of a generator here, which will keep moving, right? And why not put garbage at one end and have a light bulb over here and have your garbage dumped down there, generate the electricity. Holographic universe is a way of, again, dealing with how information is utilized. So not only do physicists have gone beyond saying okay, black holes exist, they figure out how to use them. They can use it as a microscope, because they figure that as things get stretched in there, things get stretched out, so wavelengths become longer, so we can look at things. Some very, very exotic things which are just happening right now. And I just want, again, just to emphasize, some of these solutions, 2006, 2008, were at the tip of the iceberg. When I was your age, black holes were only those things studied by the exotic few, right? No major university would have a team of researchers working on black holes if you're into astronomy. You work on Jupiter, you work on Mars, the moon, you know what I mean? Now, nearly every major university has programs dealing with the eccentricities of these objects called black holes. So there we go. I'll end with that, because this way I know you have to eat at 5:30. So I have to rush to the end, but there we go. So I hope you got